Okay, hi everybody. I am super, super excited because I am joined now by one of my favorite filmmakers and one of my just favorite human beings on the planet, a man who gives more to movie lovers than almost anyone I can name, Mr. Adam Green. How are you, sir?
I'm good. Thank you for having me.
It is super cool of you to take time out. I know you have a ton going on, and so it's super cool of you to take time out in the name of this cause. I am very excited and also nervous to talk to you because, as I said, you are just somebody whose work I love. I can't tell you how many times I've gone back and rewatched the first two seasons of Holliston. Like, that is my go-to if I'm having a bad day, if I'm having a good day, if I just want something on, like while I'm wrapping Christmas gifts. It's always Holliston. I've seen every one of your movies. Yeah, I've seen every one of your movies a bunch of times, with the exception, of course, of Coffee and Donuts. But what can you do?
If you've seen Holliston, you've seen Coffee and Donuts. Yeah, Holliston is now in its 16th year of me working on that. And it's funny, like, every now and then you meet people who are like, I've been working on this project for a year, or like, it's been 2 years trying to get this thing going. And I'm always like, dude, give me a break. like, for something that seems like it's, I guess, not simple. It's a very difficult show to put together, but it's taken, I mean, everything that could go wrong has gone wrong. I mean, originally it was set up as a major network show in 2003, and then there was a merger between UPN and the WB, and so all development was lost, and they held the rights for 5 years, which sucked because it was the rights to my life. And so, I mean, that Holliston was the thing that I came out to Hollywood to do. Like, that was always the dream project. And so then I went and made a bunch of movies, and then when the rights came back to me, then it was G4 that contacted me, and they're like, we want to do a show based around you and Joe Lynch. Like, do you have any ideas? I'm like, I've got just the idea. And then went through that development process, and that was when Corey English and Laura Ortiz and Dee Snider and Dave Rocky all became part of it. And then there was a merger, and G4 became the Esquire Network. And that time, though, I never signed any contracts because I knew better. So the rights were still mine. And then about a year after that, that was when Peter Block became the president of Fearnet. And he's like, I'm the president of Fearnet. And I was like, you're the president of a website? And he's like, no, it's a cable network. I'm like, well, then you need to call it something else. Like, fear.edu, fear.gov, or whatever. And so we made the show against impossible odds, and we were told that Fearnet would be carried in like 70 million homes by the time that season one was going to air. And instead, they were carried in like 16 homes, and it was like impossible for anyone to see it. But it still found a way, and with us touring and doing conventions like every weekend, and and then finally, like, especially by season two, the show was like really hitting its stride. We had this amazing audience. The response from critics were great. And then not only did we lose a cast member, but Fearnet went under in another merger between Time Warner and Comcast. So thankfully, I own the show. Like, Fearnet only licensed it, so the rights are still mine. And it's just been, you know, there was a solid 2 years where I just needed to walk away from it and get over losing Dave.
Yeah.
And now that things are moving again, you know, oddly enough, it was the spinoff podcast that sort of brought the show back, because now it's Geek Nation that wants to do the show, which is, you know, it really makes a lot of sense, because for the first time ever, everybody can watch it, and everybody, even in other countries, they'll be able to watch it. at the same time, which is great. I think 5 years ago, I probably wouldn't have done it because it seemed like a show that was on a streaming digital network wasn't a real TV show. But obviously, that's changed drastically. So that's exciting. But then very recently, all of a sudden, there's other things happening with it that are all really, really amazing and positive. But thankfully, or not thankfully, for people that have been waiting so long, but you know, Joe is busy in production on a movie, and I'm in production on a movie, and Dee is touring, doing like the final Twisted Sister shows ever. So it's not like we would even be able to be shooting the show anytime too soon, because we have to finish our other obligations. Right. That's one of the hardest things about this, is that when you have a cast where like the two main leads are directors who are working directors, and then you have a rock star and two working actresses, like trying to line everyone's schedules up to have time to do this is really hard. So anyway, so while we wait for our schedules to line up, there's other stuff in the works where the show, I can't say anything and I don't want to jinx it, but there's some pretty exciting stuff happening with it. And maybe it'll be somewhere other than Geek Nation or besides Geek Nation. Not that the Geek Nation thing wouldn't be great, but if things happen the way it's being talked about, we would actually have like a real serious, like awesome budget. And I don't know. It's too good to be true. And the one thing I've learned is anything I do, it always has to be done the hardest way possible. So I'm not holding my breath, but it's been a crazy last 2 months.
I'm hoping for the serious big budget, just because I feel like the one thing the show has always missed is CGI robots, like giant CGI robots that live in the apartment or next door. You know, either way, one thing that hopefully you can talk about, and if you can't, let me know, that was recently announced was the Holliston comic book that's coming out in the fall.
Yeah, Friendship is Tragic is the name of it, and it's a graphic novel. So I think it's like 52 pages or 57 pages.
Nice.
And it's in the final stages of coloring, and this has been my first experience with like the only other comic experience I really had was when Tim Seeley did the Hack/Hatchet crossover.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's really Tim's baby and his thing. I was just sort of like an advisor on it and just approving certain things. But this has been an incredible experience. And the guys at Source Point Press, you know, we over the years, so many people have approached us about doing a Holliston comic, but I never felt like they really got it. And what I didn't want was to agree to do it, and then I wound up having to do all the work for them, and I had to write everything, and I just didn't have time. And these guys really had such a great handle on it, and the writing and the artwork, it's just so Holliston. And the very first draft of it that I had read after we had developed the outline and everything else, like, it was already so close to done. Like, they did such a good job with it. So we're really excited, and I'm supposed to be able to actually like hold it and read the whole thing in about like 2 or 3 weeks. So that'll be out in time for Halloween. And there's three other comic books coming, which have not been announced yet, but that have to deal with other properties of mine. Which I'm sure people can probably guess at least but one of those
Spiral. We're obviously talking about Spiral.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah, Spiral, the comic. It's just super boring. It's exciting. I don't know when that's going to actually be announced, but the companies behind these comics are like, when I look at my at my bookshelves. Like, I already own like all their stuff, so it's really awesome because I'm already a fan. And as soon as they contacted me, I'm like, I know you. Yes. So that's really exciting too. But yeah, four different comics in development right now, plus the movie that we're making, which I can't talk about. This is why, like, I've been trying to not do interviews, because I know how annoying that is when it's like, well, what can you talk about? But yeah, that, and then writing season 3 of Holliston, and then all these new developments with Holliston, and then doing the podcast. And this weekend, Lynch and I are shooting the pilot for a different TV show that a very, very big company approached us about wanting to do a show that we carried. And we thought we were on a prank show when we went to the meeting.
And it was, you've been X'd. You're like, well, I don't know what that means. I don't know.
That's exactly what it felt like. Cause we were, it was the night we kept putting off this meeting, just thinking like, this is bullshit. And like, there's whatever, we don't have time for this. And then it was the night that we were shooting Lynch's episode of Scary Sleepover. So it was like last November, and Joe, like, we're in pajamas, and Joe looks at me and he's like, shit. He's like, we have that meeting in 45 minutes. I'm like, I thought you were going to postpone it or cancel it. And he's like, I thought you were going to cancel it. So we had to go just because we forgot to cancel it. And then we realized where we were and who we were meeting with, and we were panicking. I'm like, holy shit. Like, this is serious. Like, this is really big. And so one thing led to another, and it's been developed. And now we start shooting in like 36 hours. So again, like, it's, because it's not an Arescope thing, it's up to them when they're going to announce. But if this thing goes as they're saying it is and as planned, it'll be on a major network, and we'll be shooting more of them soon. But really, really cool idea, dealing with haunted houses. And it's, I don't know, the whole thing, I just keep waiting to like wake up and be like, right, I had this weird dream that all this stuff happened. But the whole meeting, I was waiting for us to like show that we were that excited. And then they were going to be like, you're on this new show called Assholes. Like, these two idiots actually think that a network is going to do a show about them. Like, watch what happens when we bring them in and promise them the world just to tell them that we're kidding. So, I mean, at this point, I feel like I've been lied to, and I've seen everything bad that can happen. So nothing really phases me anymore.
Right, right.
But this is really exciting. And we've been practicing and learning our lines, and we're ready to start shooting on Saturday.
That's really, really cool. So this is like an in front of the camera thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Which, you know, both of us were acting long before we were ever directing and writing. But I think because, well, I guess since Holliston, now most people understand that we're actors. But I remember when Holliston was first announced, the original response was like, what? Like, they're not actors. It's like, dude, we're playing ourselves. Like, I've got 40 years of experience doing that. Like, I'm pretty good at that. Like, it's not like, you know, Gary Oldman has to start worrying that I'm going to take his roles from him, you know, like. But when it comes to just playing myself or a version of myself, I've got a pretty good handle on that.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's been really fun. But we're both members of SAG. We've both made our living acting at times, and so yeah, it's fun to get to do more of that, especially when you're on set and the like making your day. And all of the other shit that's going wrong, or the financing, and like none of that is our problem. So we're sitting at craft service drinking coffee and like hanging out like everyone else gets to do on a set. It's really nice.
Because this would be like the first, I guess, major, you've done acting before, but you know, a lot of the acting you've done in recent years has been in your own stuff, whether it's Holliston or Digging Up the Marrow or whatever. So like, yeah, you don't have to worry about all the behind the scenes stuff. You can just.
Yeah, we just have to worry about being on camera. I mean, like, of course, they sent us the script and I instantly rewrote it and sent it back. But I mean, there's certain things I can't help myself from doing, but I mean, it's been a very collaborative process. I mean, even coming up with the concept and stuff that this company we're working with, and again, I'm sorry, I'm speaking cryptically.
No, but that's okay.
But it's just been really fun and it's and really cool. And it also helps because the company we're doing this with is so respected. We know so much of their work and they're so good at what they do. So there's a lot of trust there. It's not like working with somebody that maybe you haven't actually seen them make anything that you really liked yet or something, you know, or even executives who are just sort of temporarily at a studio or a network until they move to the next place. And you don't know really who they are or what their taste is, or like, these are people that we can really trust and they've been so, so cool to us. And it's been just like, there's just no ego involved. It's just super collaborative and everyone's throwing out ideas and it's just, it, I don't know. It's too good to be true. So, well, I guess we'll see. We should talk after we shoot. Then I'll be like, it was a fucking nightmare.
They took us out in the swamp and it was freezing.
Yeah. It was gay porn. Like I had no idea. Yeah. So far so good.
Doubling back to Holliston really quick, like, what was it about that material where you were like, I want to do this as a sitcom? Because one of the things I love about the show is how much it embraces sitcom conventions and the way the camera is set up and the laughs and all that stuff, that it's very much, it really doubles down on like, it's a sitcom. It doesn't try to be above that. It embraces it, which I love, and then it kind of breaks the fourth wall. But what was it about like a sitcom that you really wanted to do?
Well, I think I kind of have a love-hate thing with sitcoms where there's certain shows that I grew up watching that I just loved so much, like The Golden Girls or Seinfeld or Taxi. And when a sitcom is done well, what's so amazing about it is the theatrical experience of it feels like you're watching live theater and the live audience and the laugh track. And I can tell you, like, from an acting standpoint, and even from a writing and directing standpoint, that instant gratification of doing taped live theater is so fun. And being able to like deliver a joke and instantly hear a laugh. And, you know, for a lot of sitcoms these days don't have any audience at all anymore. They only use a laugh track. I don't get how that can work because so much of your rhythm and your pacing has to do with the laugh spread. And sometimes things that you thought were going to get a laugh don't, or things that you didn't realize were that funny, the people are laughing forever. So we have a small audience that we play off of, and then we fill that in with the laugh track. Season one, we tried to be very obvious with the laugh track and like purposely obnoxious with it, to the point that we would like purposely use the same laugh over and over again just to try to be funny. But then I think starting with the Christmas special, we started to back off of that a little bit and just go naturally with what we had. So that aspect of it is just so rewarding and so fun. And it's, you know, when you're watching it at home, it feels like you're in an audience watching it. Especially now with surround sound, like when we mix the show and you're on the mix stage and you hear the audience from behind you and all around you laughing, it just, I don't know, it just, it's a very fun thing to do. So I think that what I always wanted was to see a sitcom that I would watch that was like for me, that was about the things that I was interested in. And I was kind of hellbent on making a show that's in a mainstream format, but that treats horror fans like we really are and like real people who actually have emotions and go through heartbreaks and have dreams that get crushed and doors slammed in our faces and friendships. And because a lot of times in the mainstream, at least, horror fans are treated as like sight gags, or they're written from the perspective of people that aren't really into it,
right,
but think they get it.
Right.
And I've heard some people say that about Big Bang Theory. There was one review that I read of, I think, of Holliston that referred to Big Bang Theory as, I don't like this term, but it was nerd blackface. And I was like, whoa, like that's a pretty bold statement.
Yeah.
But I guess I can see what they're talking about, where it feels like the people writing it are doing their interpretation of nerds and geeks. But, you know, like with Holliston, we're horror fans, but there's more to life than just that. We're not like all gothed out and pierced and tattooed, and all we do is talk about killing people. So, you know, it's like, so the feedback that we started getting instantly, there were just so many thank you letters, which was a weird thing to see, but it was people thanking us for portraying horror fans as real people, and that we, like, I guess, got it right, which, I mean, that's who we really are. So it would have been pretty messed up if we got it wrong. But I just think that horror fans appreciated getting to finally see themselves as lead characters on a show and handled like they're human beings. So it's also been great because that show, it had a lot of crossover, where when we would do certain appearances, there was like full-on families coming to see the live performances or to meet us. And the first thing they would tell us is that they don't like horror movies. They're like, I'm not into this at all. I've never been to a horror convention, but this show kind of got me into it. Like, I had a perception of what horror was, and I was so wrong. And I mean, you've been to conventions. I'm sure most of the people listening to this have been to conventions. Like, horror fans and metal fans are some of the nicest people you'll ever meet. Like, I just was in Europe for 2 weeks with Twisted Sister, and like France and Sweden and Austria. And I don't even necessarily speak the same language, but everybody I met there was like instantly a friend. Like, everybody was so nice to each other. It's like, oh, you're into this? I'm into this too. Let's be friends. And you can go to a horror convention and not know anybody, but if you put out just the most minimal amount of effort and just say hello or smile or be nice, like, people are going to be cool to you. And I don't feel like other genres really have that type of camaraderie or that sense of community.
Yeah, no, totally. I, you know, if I'm wearing, sometimes I'll go to conventions and I'll even like wear my Holliston t-shirt, and then, you know, I'll get people saying like, "Ooh, cool shirt," or like, yeah. And then, you know, that you're friends with that person because you have something in common with them right away.
Yeah. It's cool. I wish more people understood that about us as fans and as a community. I mean, look at what you're doing right now with this 18-hour podcast, you know, for such a good cause, or the fact that like Monster Mania in New Jersey, like a big part of their convention every year is doing an auction to help the Save a Yorkie Foundation. Like,
yeah, right, and you did Boston Strong, but and that was all horror people just like stepping up in a huge way, right? And donating stuff and raising money.
Yeah, you know, it's I put that together because it was my hometown, and obviously that whole marathon bombing tragedy really struck me. And so, like, I mean, somebody had to do something, and so I try to play sort of, I guess not play it down, but I try to not take credit for it because I might have put it together and been the face of it, but it was really everybody. Like, as soon as I said that I was putting that thing together, and, you know, it wasn't enough to just do an auction or one screening, like, because it's me, it had to be as difficult as possible. It had to be 3 days in three different spots in Massachusetts so that everybody would have a chance to attend something. But then the whole community just started reaching out, and from John Carpenter and Wes Craven and Rob Zombie and Eli and all the fans that started giving, like, I mean, everybody just started calling me and saying, how can I help? And can I give you this? And can I give you that? I didn't have to go like begging or asking them to do it. They just, that's just the types of people that we are. And I think there's something about, for most of us who are attracted to this type of stuff, genre stuff, whether it's horror, comic books, or metal music, whatever it might be, there's some aspect in growing up where we felt like we didn't quite fit in, or we weren't the cool kids, or we weren't going to be like first on the call sheet of life. Like, and I think because we all have that in common, we're that much quicker to be cool to each other and to help each other. And I don't know. I mean, being at Monster Mania and hearing that they do an auction for Yorkies, which obviously anybody who follows me knows my dog Arwen very well. Hmm. I was like, all right, well, okay, how can I help with this? And so I auctioned myself off for a date with a fan, and I auctioned off a screen used prop from Hatchet 2. And so together, like, we raised over $7,000, which might not sound like it's that much money, but it doesn't cost that much money to help a Yorkie. And this is an organization that's volunteer run. And basically what happens is that people buy Yorkies or get them from breeders or whatever because they're cute. And then they wind up having medical problems, like problems with their eyes or their legs. And it's literally just that the owners don't want to deal with it, or they don't want to pay for it. And so they dump them at shelters, or just like literally throw them out on the street. And this is like a, you know, a 6 to 11 pound dog. Like, it can't fend for itself and it's sick. And this organization heals these animals, and then it does like an extensive interview process of figuring out the right home for it, because these dogs have already lost everything once. They can't go through that again. So they want to make sure wherever they go, it's permanent and it's the right place. I think too many people adopt a pet because it seems like a good idea at the time, but they don't understand that it's for life and that it's like a child. Right. And this thing is going to be dependent on you till the day it dies. And when people use the term putting an animal to sleep or euthanized, like, the definition of euthanized is putting something out of its misery. Like, when you euthanize a perfectly healthy dog just because nobody wants it, that you're killing it. You're not putting it out of its misery necessarily. So it's tough, but being at Monster Mania and you see all these people walking around covered in blood and guts and all their favorite scary horror movie t-shirts. And then in the other room, there's this auction going on to save the Yorkies.
Right.
And all these people holding these little, like, adorable dogs. and it's great to see. And like we were saying before we started recording with the Movie Crypt podcast, that's the 3-day fundraiser that Joe and I are going to be doing in August. It's like the first weekend in August, we're going to stay on the air for the whole weekend. And it's all to raise money to benefit that Yorkie shelter. And it just, you know, we wanted to do something to give back now that the podcast is so popular and successful. And given that our mascot is a Yorkie and everyone knows Arwen, it just made sense to pick that one. But the amount of celebrity guests, as soon as they got wind of what we were doing, that have been calling us saying, how can I be part of that? I want to come on the show. I want to donate. I want to give something. Again, it's like no other genre is like that. It just isn't. You would think it would be like the romantic comedy people that would be like that. But it's not. Like, I think they're some of the most fucked up people there are.
Well, horror is, you know, the only genre where there's just like such a sense of community where, you know, especially now thanks to like social media or whatever, I have friends all over the country because this thing that we share and they're actual friends, you know, they're not just like people I talk to on Twitter every once in a while. And it's because we share this thing in common. I don't feel like there's any other genre that bonds people together the way horror does.
No, not at all. Not at all.
All right. I know I don't want to keep you. I will kill myself if I don't ask you at least a question about your movies, because like I said, I love them all and I watch them all over and over again.
You
directed 2 Hatchet movies and wrote and produced and kind of masterminded Hatchet 3, but with the exception of like those.
That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. All right. With the exception of those sequels. One of the things I love about you as a filmmaker is that you never have made the same movie twice. And each time something comes out, it's like, wow, this is totally different. And yet you can see, you know, the threads between each of them, even in Holliston. It's like there is a voice that's across all three. And so I guess the question I would ask is there a part of you before you start a project, like you're in production on something now, is there a part of you before you start where you're like, I want to do something different? I know Spiral was like a conscious choice so as to not get pigeonholed as like, you're the hatchet guy, here's 20 slasher movies. But like, or is it just, are you just kind of following a muse? Like, this is the particular story I want to tell? Or like, how conscious are you of each time pivoting away and doing something kind of different?
That's a really good question. Like you said, with Spiral, I saw, you know, Joel Moore and Jeremy Boring wrote that movie. And when Joel asked me to co-direct it, instantly my knee-jerk reaction was no, like, co-directing doesn't work. But I saw such a great, like, I loved the script. Yeah. I loved that it was like a jazz movie. And I saw the opportunity there where Spiral and Hatchet were going to come out around the same time, and Spiral would save me from being the Hatchet guy for the rest of my life. So in that regard, it was a little bit of a conscious choice, but it was also just sort of a stroke of luck that that project happened to come my way. But the rest of the time, it's really just whatever gets me excited. I mean, it was definitely a conscious choice to wait between Hatchet sequels. Like, we could have done Hatchet 2 right away, but yeah, I wanted to go do other things. And then that way, when I did Hatchet 2, I was all in, and I was super excited to do it. And it wasn't just the next thing. It was important to me. And same thing with Hatchet 3. And like, people are always saying, like, is there ever going to be another one or whatever? Like, if there is, it's going to be because I have to do it. Like, I'm just like, it's taking over my body, mind, and soul, and I can't think about anything else. Because to direct a movie, it's like having a child, and you have to love it so much because the entire process sucks. And it's forget the fact that you have this vision and you know exactly how to achieve that vision, but then you're given nothing close to what you need to actually do that. So you're just constantly compromising. And what you end up with is this like kind of sort of bastardized version of what you wanted to do. And you have to live with that and then own it and then take criticism on it. And it's like, what the best is when someone's like, what they should have done. It's like, you don't think that we knew that. I made the mistake at an early screening once of Hatchet 2 of being honest and saying, we only had 15 days to make this movie. And there's 17 elaborate kills in this movie. Like, it was so hard, a huge cast and all of this stuff. And we did it in 15 days. And then somebody had written, like, maybe if Green wasn't in such a rush and would just spend more time, like, do you think like, the budget was like, you can shoot for 40 days if you want. And I was like, ah, fuck it. Let's do it in 15. Like, just
I got shit to do.
Like, you go home every night, like, throwing up on yourself. Like, oh, God, you're like Oscar Schindler. Like, if I only could have had one more. So that's anyway. But as far as the decision goes, it's really just sort of whatever grabs hold and gets me excited enough to be willing to go through that very painful and hard, difficult process. Like, I don't understand the directors who are directors for hire, who just want to work and they'll do anything. That's like, if somebody offers them something, they're like, fuck it, I'll take it. It's a job. And there's nothing wrong with that. They have something that I wish I had, because I'd probably be a wealthier person. And to anybody who's listening, who wants to be a filmmaker, don't do what I did, man. Like, if you have like a really successful movie, just keep making that movie, because like, that's where the money is. Whereas I was like, now I'm going to do an artsy jazz movie. And then I'm going to do like a movie about a dead baby. I'm going to produce a movie about a dead baby.
Oh, yes.
That's the most non-commercial thing ever. Like, so I've just like, I've just always done whatever I feel like I have to do at that time creatively. And thankfully, I have this fan base that is so different from everybody else's fan base. Like, everyone always likes to say, like, oh, my fans are the best, and it's lip service, but like, my fans are the best. Like, they really are. Like, they're so willing to give me a chance. Like, if I'm like, I'm going to do something like Digging Up the Marrow, this is totally different. I don't even know how you describe it. It's inspired by artwork, but just trust me on this and go with it. And they did, and they give it a fair chance. And it doesn't mean everyone's 100% always going to love everything equally that I do, but they're willing to support it and see it and go into it with an open mind. And I've been very lucky that I have that, because there's other directors who don't. Like, every time they try to do something different, it's like they get punished by their fan base. Like, don't do that. Go just keep making the same thing that we like. And I've been very, very lucky that I've been able to do that, and that I have such a versatile crew, and I work with the same people all the time, and that they trust me, and they're willing to go on all these crazy various adventures with me and do this stuff. I mean, the same people that made Frozen and Hatchet made Holliston, and that's like, you know, they couldn't be more different. But it's I guess, I don't know, maybe in some ways that's everybody's dream, is that they want to be able to just keep making different things and making the things they want to make. And I never take that for granted, and I'm so grateful that I do get to do it. But the price that I've had to pay is that every time you set out to do something new, especially if it's something that hasn't exactly been done before, then you wind up having to work with such a small budget. I mean, forget the fact that there's no revenue anymore for independent movies. Like, everybody waits for Netflix. Like, when you watch something on Netflix, the filmmaker is never going to get a dime for that, ever. And Netflix, like, that whole system, there needs to be a major strike. It needs to be changed, but it's horrible. And that's why you might notice, like, right now, I don't think any of my things are on Netflix.
No.
I'm not fighting to get them on Netflix. I would rather people not watch them than be watching it for free. I just would. It's not always up to me. It's up to the distributor. And so, you know, the movies will kind of come and go on Netflix. And I get it. Like, why pay for it if you can watch it on Netflix? But thankfully, I have enough fans that are willing to go out of their way to see these things when they're in theaters, to buy the Blu-rays or the DVDs, or buy it on iTunes or even VOD, whatever it might be. Because as soon as these things stop recouping their money, then I don't get to make any more movies. It's that simple. So, the piracy thing is obviously, don't even get me started on that. But I've been very fortunate that I have fans that are willing to do that. And it's never been harder to make movies than right now. And I'm constantly worried about new filmmakers, because, like, how do you convince somebody to give you a real budget for something if you don't already have a track record, and if you don't already have a following, or if you don't have a bankable huge star? And how are you going to get that star when they've never seen anything you've done before, and you don't have the money to pay them? Like, it's really hard. And, you know, occasionally something lucks out and it'll get selected for Sundance or Cannes or Toronto and make a huge splash, and it gets that momentum behind it. But for the rest of the world, you know, they just want to follow their dream and make their movie and tell their story. And now they're having to do it for like 50 grand or like 20. Like, how do you even make a real movie at that budget level? And I know right now someone's like, I could do it. Found footage. That's not a real movie. So it's really hard. And I'm grateful that I got my start at a time period when the industry wasn't quite in the shambles that it's in now. My entire career has been during this process, so every year it's gotten worse and worse. And I don't know, you sort of have this grand dream when you start that it's the first one that's going to be really hard. Like when we made Hatchet 1 and we only had 1.5 and it was such a struggle. And then it was like, it was a big hit and it made a ton of money for all these people that had nothing to do with it. And then it's like, all right, cool. Well, now the next one, you know, we've proven ourselves. Look at how much money that made. Here we go. No, it doesn't work like that. Well, now the industry's changed. Now there's no more home video. Now there's no more Blockbuster. Now there's no more this. So revenues have gone down and it's a business. So, you know, why is somebody going to give you money unless they have some sort of guarantee at a return? It's really hard, but trying to end this on a positive note, I think that what we've been doing is we have this, like, this amazing fan base worldwide, all these people that have watched our stuff, millions of people. And they're used to watching these things wherever they watch movies, whether it's on cable or Netflix or whatever, but they know about us and they know about our movies. And so, you know, Joe and I do the podcast, which has become hugely successful. There's like 500,000 people listening every week. And then doing things like, you know, all the free stuff that I do for the fans, like Scary Sleepover and Horrified. And so by starting to kind of harness everybody and get them used to coming directly to Arescope and to me to see stuff, mm-hmm. I think that eventually it's still going to take a while, but there might someday be a way where I can just make things and go right to the fans and no longer have to deal with these distributors and their decisions or like, you know, like, or the fact that when something is successful, they're the ones who are going to see any profits. Like, I mean, I can't even tell you how much money those three Hatchet movies have generated at this point. And I'll never see any of it. So it's bittersweet. But at the end of the day, you don't make horror movies because you think you're going to be rich. I just want to be able to keep going is really it. If I can just pay my bills and live comfortably and know that I can make more movies, then, you know, what else can I ask for? But back in the 80s, like there are dudes that I'm friends with that like made one successful like horror movie in 1980, whatever. And they have like a mansion in the hills and they're like, and they haven't worked since, but it was a different time. So, but I can't complain. I'm just grateful that I get to do this and grateful for every day I'm here and grateful for the fans and that I'm part of such a great community. I think it's awesome that you're doing this in honor of your friend. I think it's, I hope that it does its job in raising awareness and that as much as people are going to be listening to this show and the interviews you do and enjoying it, that they're remembering why you're doing it and thinking about that. Because it's important, and I'm proud of you that you're doing this.
Thank you so much. That's really, really beautiful. Thank you. You know, and again, just thank you for everything that you do, not just the work that you do, which I love, which brings me joy, but also just every way that you give back to fans, whether it's engaging with them on Facebook or, you know, the podcast that you do every week where you're helping out kind of new filmmakers, people are up and coming, raising money for different charities, just being so open and accessible and just really just everything you do. Thank you so, so much. You're just a great person. I can't thank you enough.
You're welcome. I'm just the dude that my mom raised. Like, I'm just, that's it. But if there's one thing I want people to remember me for is that I'm the one who said, yes, you can, because everyone's going to tell you no, and everyone's going to tell you the odds, but I'm telling everybody, yes, you can. My dad was a gym teacher. Like every teacher told me to think of anything else to do for a career besides this. It wouldn't happen. Every day we see the odds, the sales figures, the, you know, how hard it is. Everyone's going to pirate it anyway, and there's no hope, and there's no this and that, and the world's going to shit, and everyone's shooting each other, and if you go see the movies, you're going to get stabbed, and you're going to, like, fuck all of that. Just be a good person and say yes. Like, just say yes. Just do it. Whatever it is you want to do. thank you for having me on. I appreciate it. I'm honored to be a part of what you're doing. And I wish you the best and good luck with the remaining of your 18 hours.
Thank you again so, so much. And good luck with the shoot this weekend with Lynch. I can't wait to see whatever that ends up being. And obviously, I'll be very, very tuned in to everything that you have coming up. So thank you again.
Thank you. I'll talk to you later, Patrick.
All right. Thank you, Adam.